I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Good evening. I'm Pat Prescott. Welcome to Justice Now, Communities to Unity, a Radio.com original brought to you by My2020Census.gov. Take 10 minutes to change the next 10 years. And remember, the census deadline is September 30th. In today's America, there's a long list of familiar names whose faces are black and brown, who are among the richest and the most successful athletes and entertainers in the world. As they should be, when their talents enrich not only themselves and their families, but all of the agents and the managers and producers, the staff and the corporations that benefit as well. But look at where they came from and what many had to go through to get to where they are today. And then listen to the stories of those who went before, and you will see a pattern of bias and exclusion. The history reveals the stereotypical images that clearly reflect whites' attitudes about blacks more than anything else, instead of reflecting the actual black experience in all of its beauty, variety, and complexity. You might know the story of Stepan Fetchit, who was the first black person to appear in a motion picture. Or Jackie Robinson, who was first to break the color barrier in Major League Baseball. There have been many more firsts in sports and entertainment, but the focus now is on becoming more inclusive on the management and ownership levels, and on using the power and clout of celebrity to control our own images and to further advance our causes. Tonight on Justice Now, Communities to Unity, we welcome 3-time Laker champion Byron Scott, Keith Knight, creator of the new Hulu series Woke, actress Kim Coles of In Living Color fame, Grey's Anatomy star James Pickens Jr., and a panel of comedians including Alonzo Bowden, Tommy Davidson, and George Wallace. We'll look beyond the red carpet, the cheering fans, and the spotlights to take a closer look at racism in sports and entertainment.
Now, 94.7 The Wave's ongoing pursuit to bring communities to unity.
We'll start with an introduction of our panel. First of all, a young man who's been making us laugh for over 20 years now. He's one of the best and the brightest out there, in my opinion. His new stand-up special is Heavy Lightweight. It is streaming on Amazon Prime. He has 2 comedy specials on Showtime, and he was the winner of season 3 of NBC's Last Comic Standing. Y'all know I'm talking about Alonzo Bowden. Welcome, Alonzo.
Thank you yes. so much, Pat. I am honored to be here with 2 masters of the game.
Yes, indeed. And let's meet one of those masters now, who is a singer, an actor,
a comedian. Did you call him a bastard?
Master.
Here come one of the bastards now. Okay.
All right, don't interrupt Tommy's introduction. He is a singer, he's an actor, he's a comedian. His brilliant work on the hit TV show In Living Color kind of opened the door to TV and film for him. He recently spent 3 years hosting ABC's Vacation Creation and recently released his personal memoir, Living in Color, What's Funny About Me, detailing his very unusual life story. Hope we'll get to hear a little bit of that today from Tommy Davidson. Hey, Tommy.
Hi. Good to be here. 2 of the vets, my favorites, greatest achiever over here with Alonzo, and greatest achievements over on the other side.
I like it. Yeah. Let's talk about Mr. George Wallace, who really was born funny and has kept us laughing the whole time. After 10 years at the Flamingo, the new Mr. Vegas is back on the road now doing what he loves best. I think that he's in a hotel room right now. He is an author. He is a motivational speaker. He was awarded the 2013 Soul Train Lifetime Achievement Honor and is a four-time nominee and one-time winner of the Best Stand-Up Comedian of the prestigious American Comedy Awards. He is loved by fans and really just adored by fellow comedians, as you can see right here. Mr. George Wallace with us today. Hey, George.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's my nap time. It's my nap time. I was taking my nap. They called it TM. I was TM.
That's what happens in those hotel rooms, isn't it?
Yes.
And I know you have all been in a bunch of hotel rooms throughout your careers and a lot of other places as well. And we're here to talk about entertainment and systemic racism in it. And I know racism is not funny to people who are dealing with it, but part of what your job has been throughout your career really is to make people laugh about those things. And talk a little bit about the role of comedy in that. I mean, I think it's kind of historic that's been the way it is throughout the history.
Fortunately, you have chosen three comedians that do cross over comedy. All three of us can handle any audience, and that's very unusual to find. And me being probably the first, I'm sure I'm the first of the three to start in comedy and work in nothing but white rooms. They didn't even want black comedians in the rooms when I started. And it was me and Jimmy Walker and maybe Byron Allen. And you can smile if you want to.
Comedian.
It hasn't been too many years since they started allowing a lot of black comedians to come into the clubs. So it's been systemic racism for all our lives, to be honest.
Yeah, and the stereotypes. I mean, I started in the early 90s, and that was Def Jam era. And they tried to put us all in that category. Like every black comic has to be from the hood and this, that, the other. Not acknowledging the fact that black people, like any people, come from a full spectrum and a wide range. So I dealt with that early in my career, being the suburban brother.
There you go. Yeah, it's been there. I got a chance to experience it mid 80s to kind of almost 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the tail end of what George is talking about when I hit Hollywood. The only place that I could really play, you know, and really go and really be a star was the Comedy Act Theater.
Yes.
And every other club in town, besides, you know, Total Experience and Marla's Memory Lane and stuff that was, you know, for us, every single club from the Magic Club, from Ice House, just all the clubs, Comedy Store, they would always say, I bring the house down every time. They'd always say, you're not what we're looking for. I would go, well, what's that? You're just not what we're looking for. And so it made sense to me that I guess it's black because all the comics were white.
Yeah.
You're not what we're looking for.
There have always been those code words, right? Like, we decided to go another way.
Right. Yes.
Different direction.
You're a little too urban.
Right.
Hey, Pat, when I started in the late 70s and Tommy, the early mid 80s and Lonzo, the 90s, you know, pretty much at the time, I think, Tommy, you guys correct me, it was pretty much one of us on a show. Pretty much one black on a show.
Yeah. I think it was, there were two. It was Byron Allen and Arsenio Hall.
That's still one. I meant at the comedy club, so we were working out. That was pretty much one black guy on the show.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, well, we've seen that, you know, in so many different arenas. I know for you, Tommy, the whole thing with In Living Color was to be able to break a whole lot of those stereotypes. And I guess that kind of freedom must have felt really great and so unusual at the time.
Yeah, we didn't think it was going to get on the air for those reasons. And then another reason was we waited 6 months. So we just all went back to work, you know, hustling at the clubs or whatever we needed to do. because there was definitely nothing on air that represented Black comedians and the Black experience. Nothing at all.
Nothing.
As far as the cast goes, Eddie was on Saturday Night Live and other people individuals were on there. But just as a group, Blacks haven't been looked at as Black comedians, actors, and all that. Hadn't been looked at citizens of this U.S. that are actually American. You know? It's like y'all in that group. You know?
Right. Yeah, no, that show made such a huge impact, too. And what do you think it did to affect the way people looked at racial stereotypes and at Black and brown people in general? Because that's mostly what you saw on that show. And doing so many different things.
Right, right. I actually didn't think that they saw any difference because they laughed, you know? It's just that no one really realized that Blacks actually laugh at the same thing white people laugh at. You know, you could ask any Black person you want, you know, what's some of your favorite shows? They're going to say Andy Griffin. The Honeymooners. Man, they're going to say the Brady Bunch. Man, they're going to say, because we look at shows for shows. You know what I mean? They're the only ones that look at it that way. So they finally, the tables were turned where they could look at it from our window. Hey, it's a laugh.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I know, Alonzo, for you, you are, to me, one of the smartest comics who's out there today who can talk about politics and talk about regular life too, and really make it funny, but also make people think. I mean, is this something that you're doing intentionally? Is this just kind of a reflection of who you are?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. First, I want to acknowledge Living Color and Tommy. And one of the things you did, and you talked about it, Tommy, it's that the show was run by Black people, predominantly Black cast, but not all Black jokes. You know, there might be sketches about gays or about this or about things that had nothing to do with being Black, done by Black people. And that was one of the brilliant things about the show. You know, Pat, what happened in the course of my career, the news, the world became funnier to me than me. So I started talking about what was going on in the world. And I have to say, one of my comic role models and heroes is actually a white guy, George Carlin, because George Carlin did those social observations, looking at the world, looking at people, and just telling the truth. You know, that's the thing. Just telling simple truths, and a lot of them do cross over between Black and white, but obviously, and I mean, we're seeing it now, right, with the ridiculous level of police violence that a lot of white people are looking at and saying, wow, I guess they were telling the truth for these past 400 years. I don't know. You know, so now we talk about that, but to me, the comic's job has always been to tell the truth, to speak truth to power, and it goes back to the jester, who was the only guy who could tell the king the truth. But he had to make it funny, or else the king would chop off his head, which I think is great. I mean, the stakes should be that high. Like, you can say what you want, but if it's not funny, now you're not doing comedy, you're preaching. So you have to make it funny to make it palatable.
Yeah, it's got to be funny. And you know, for me now, you know, the news is just so hard to watch between coronavirus and the election and the civil unrest and all of these things. I find I have to, like, watch, you know, Trevor Noah, or I need jokes with my news. George,
and
you've been making
jokes about racism, systemic racism, and it goes all the way back forever, and it's still happening today. Just let's take a guy like Sammy Davis Jr. And even Richard Pryor and those guys working the clubs couldn't go through the front door in Las Vegas. They had to go through the back, through the kitchen. So the systemic racism goes on and on in a new way. Now, even today, it's happening. Right now, the comedy club's now pretty much booking Black acts because that's who fills the rooms now. They still don't really want us in there, but it's money. It's all about money. So racism every time, everywhere you turn. And so, and you mentioned about what's happening today, Black Lives Matter, the 19, I always like to say 45 too. COVID 45 is my pain in the ass more than anything else. I've never hated anybody before. I've never hated anybody before until now. And as serious as things are, our job today is to put a twist on it and get some laughter. That's what we're doctors, and that's what we do. You come to a therapy session, we can make people feel better.
And Pat, also, I think comedians put a ring to truth. The truth is like a bell, you know what I mean? And the laugh is the bell. If the more truthful you are about something, they're going to laugh automatically. It's like a bell. You know, something about, you know, naked, unadulterated truth, it rings.
Yes.
It
rings.
It really does. And I think it takes a lot of courage to be able to dish that out. I think that the job that you guys have is one of the most difficult jobs to have in the world. And when you're going
through... Yeah, we don't
have bills. Yeah, we don't have bills. When you're going through the pain of being victims of racism yourself, and then you've got to still stand up there and make people laugh, I think that's got to be a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, and Pat, let me say one thing. Speaking of racism, it happened to me. You would not believe this. Just 2 years ago, at a hotel in Las Vegas called the South Point, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Weekend. As my intro music, I played "Lift Every Voice and Sing Till Earth and Heaven," the Negro National Anthem. I got fired for that. I was not invited back because the white people didn't understand, well, what was that all about? See, but they're learning now. Kaepernick, what was that all about? They're learning a little bit more and more, and they're giving in right now. We're going through an amazing transformation right now with the NBA teams, and there's still a lot to learn in the world. But we have to put a twist on it and then make it funny in some way.
Yeah, we certainly do. And I think as a comedian, part of what you do really is to share your life, to share your whole experience. And I know, Tommy, you've been doing a lot of that recently in your book and everything, too. And I don't know how many people really know your story. I actually heard the whole thing for the first time on a cruise to hear you talking about it. But just tell us a little bit about your story, because you're very unique in terms of this whole racial thing.
Yes.
I ended up somewhere in the middle. I was left in the trash in Greenville, Mississippi, found by a white woman randomly, was adopted then, moved to Fort Collins, Colorado, and Laramie and Casper, Wyoming. I didn't know I was black. I thought I was a brown one. See, because I saw a lot of animals get born, you know, and a cat could have a black one, a brown one, a gray one. So I thought it was a brown one of us. You know, so when we got to Washington, D.C., it was during the riots when King got shot. So that was the first thing I saw. It was tanks, fire, tear gas. We lay on the floor. We come out the house to play with the kids, naturally. And the black kids kicked our ass. I thought it was brown kids. You know, and they were calling us white cracker, calling them white cracker and calling me white cracker lover. So then we moved out to the suburbs. That's the first time I heard the word nigger. Because I got chased by grown white men everywhere, from everywhere I was. I could be on my bike. They just get out the truck and chase me or wherever I was. So I went to my mother and I said, who are these niggas? We got to stay away from them, man. Them some bad people. She said, that's what people our color call people your color. So then, right then and there, my little heart was broken. I mean, I can remember that as one of the most confusing, sad moments of my life. I was only 5. And so we moved to the suburbs and it was black and white. It was mostly white at that time, but it was getting blacker and more Latin. So the big white guys chased me. When the black guys came behind me, the white guys would run the other way, and I've been black ever since then, you see. So, and that was, I had to figure out what black was and this whole thing, and, you know, and that's a whole story in itself, but that's how I came into this. That's how I came into this world.
Yeah, I think all of us, our experience is not exactly like yours, but I mean, I think all of us have had those moments in our lives when we discovered that, you know, people felt about us a different way just because of who we are. You know, looking back on your careers and everything you've been able to do, I would love for all of you to just talk a little bit about what you think the impact of your work has been on helping the world to understand each other a little bit better. And, you know, maybe what are some of the things that could happen to bring more equity into your arena of work?
The most fun or maybe best, I don't know if best, but the most fun compliment I'll get after a show is when like a Trump person will come up and say, I don't agree with you, but that was funny. Because that's when you really, when you got somebody who definitely has their views that are completely different, But right. they still have to laugh because they know, like Tommy was saying, I rung the bell. What we said is true.
What about you, Tommy?
I think we're all the same in one way, man. I watch so many comedians. I watch black comedians, you know, of course, the right. most. You know what I'm saying? And we're all the same. We actually talk about what's funny.
You know exactly. what I
mean? Now, black being black and talking about something is going to be funny because we just got a way of putting things. Some are funnier than others doing it. You know what I mean? Yeah. But it's still mm-hmm. that same thing. But ain't nobody funnier than the next person because when it comes to black comedians, every black comedian says something funny.
Got your own way. This is so true. Yeah. Zoe, you were saying about, I tend to be a little bit harder. I don't give a damn. I'll just say what I want to say. And right now, I'll tell them right up front, I don't do Trump jokes because I have Republicans in the audience and I got Democrats and I got to make this money. So I'm not going to do no Trump jokes. So Pat, our job is to stay funny, stay funny. We got the disease out here, COVID. We got to be funny with the COVID. We got to be funny with the Black Lives Matter. We got washing our hands. We got, what else we got out there? We got the storm coming in. So we got to take all of these negatives and turn them into a plus. We got to make people laugh because when you stop laughing, you stop living. So no matter what the situation is, no matter what we do, it's not like going to a funeral. You can't go to a funeral now without somebody laughing. You got to be a joke there.
Yeah. Yeah. And what can we do to make your lives better, to make it more equitable for blacks in comedy?
Oh, nothing. Just keep laughing. For me, I got the greatest job in the world, no matter what. All I do is lie. I mean, that's all we do is just lie. I can't wait to go to work. I haven't been on stage in 5 months now, but I'm on stage right now. I feel good. Pat, you have no idea. It's the greatest therapy in the world. Laughter, the medicine, making people happy. When I say happy people, it makes me happier.
Listen, I want to thank you guys for spending some time with us today. Thanks for keeping us laughing for all these years. Can't wait to see you back on the stages again. Saw Alonzo just recently on the Nowhere Comedy Club, which is something we are revisiting now because we'll take it however we can get it. Comedy means so much to all of us, believe me.
I'm so proud of you, Alonzo. I am so proud of you.
Thanks, Tommy. Yeah,
I love you, George. You are the best, man. Mentor, friend, truth teller boy.
I don't like either of you because you're starting to take my job. So the hell with both of you.
We can't take nothing from you. We can't take nothing. Only you do that. Only George can stand on stage and say your mama jokes for 4 hours if he wanted to.
That's true. Alonzo Bowden, Tommy Davidson, George Wallace. Thank you so much for joining us on Justice Now.
We should do this once a month.
It's a pleasure to introduce you to our next guest. This is Justice Now, Communities to Unity, focusing on sports and entertainment tonight. He is a proud Inglewood native. His number 11 is retired at his alma mater, Arizona State. He's a three-time NBA champ and a beloved alumnus of the Showtime era Lakers. He went on to coach at several places in the NBA with the Nets, the Hornets, the Cavaliers, and the Lakers. And today he is a respected NBA TV analyst. I think because of his experience in sports, he is uniquely qualified to talk to us today about racism, systemic racism in the sports industry. Byron Scott joins us. How you doing, Byron?
Doing good, Pat. How are you?
I'm doing great. I know that for you, you've seen a lot. You've had a lot of years in the NBA, and I'm curious to hear what you think about what you're seeing right now, especially with this recent NBA activity down in the bubble.
Well, the one thing I can say, Pat, is I'm very proud of the players in the NBA for taking a stand for social justice. This is something that, you know, 20, 30 years ago probably wouldn't have never happened. Players, you know, forfeiting games, using their platform to speak their mind on things that they know are not going on, the things that they know are not right in America today. So I love what I'm seeing, you know, from our players. I love the fact that LeBron James has had a serious voice in this and been very impactful with his words. And the fact that he understands where we are today as a people and how this has to get much better. And I think for me, we just can't talk about it. You know, we talked about it 20 plus years ago when Rodney King situation happened. We talked about equality and justice. And it seemed to happen for a month or two, and then it just went away. I think us as a people, we're fed up with it. We're at the point right now where we want to see change. And we're not going to go quietly. You know, we're going to keep having these protests, and we're going to keep talking about it. And especially in sports, where we know our athletes are all over the place as far as numbers are concerned, that they can continue to do this and that our words will be heard. And I love the fact that our athletes are standing up for it.
Well, you know, it's not that long ago that one athlete who didn't stand, who knelt, lost his whole career because of that. In such a short time, the turnaround is kind of stunning. To what do you attribute the difference in the attitude from management and ownership today?
I don't know if the I don't know if there is a difference yet, to be honest with you, with ownerships and management. I don't know if there really is a big difference right now. What Colin Kaepernick did 4 years ago, like you said, cost him his career, cost him his livelihood. And all he was asking, he wasn't disrespecting the flag. He was asking for justice, equal rights, you know, all the things that are going on today, police brutality. Those are all the things that he talked about 4 years ago that everybody went crazy over. Our now president who jumped on him, owners wouldn't give him a fair shake anymore, all because of just what he decided to do. And that's what, and that was to take a knee and say, I'm not going to stand for this anymore. You know,
I guess that's what I'm talking about, though. This one player did that and lost his career pretty much.
Right.
Today, we're seeing the entire team, the coaches, the officials, the staff, everyone is taking a knee. You look at the National Hockey League, where there are very few black players. Right. I mean, they are joining it. What do you think is different now that makes that more acceptable to some people than in the past?
Like you said, it was only 4 years ago that he did that. What makes it different is that everybody was able to see a man be, you know, quite frankly murdered, you know, quite frankly murdered in the streets, unarmed. And it seemed that the police didn't give a damn about it, what, you know, whatsoever. And I think when that video went live, no matter what color you are, you know, most people saw that as disgusting. You know, so I think now, you know, with the protests, it wasn't just, you know, blacks, it was browns, it was whites, it was, you know, every kind of person you can name was in on those protests. So it showed that we have come a long way when it comes to racism, that all white people don't think, you know, that, you know, we are second class citizens, or that brown people are second class citizens. And I think that, you know, that reaction from people in general has gotten the attention, you know, from everybody across the board. Because, you know, like you said, 4 years ago when Colin did that, it was basically just one black man, you know, trying to make a stand. But it wasn't nothing, it wasn't a racial thing at the time. It was him basically saying that, you know, I want this to end. You know, this police brutality, this injustice, I want this to end. He stood up for that. Well, you know, obviously a lot of people took that wrong. But as we saw the murder of George Floyd in the middle of the streets, you know, like I said, it don't matter what color you are, you can see what's right and what's wrong. And that's where the stand has taken a difference.
And I think the subsequent shootings that we've seen, too, I think because we've got video now. I mean, a lot of us thought that was going to change with Rodney King. But, you know,
right, exactly.
We've got video now of footage where even if someone, you know, you have to ask yourself, does the punishment fit the crime? Should you die for of some kind of bicycle violation? Should you die? Should you be shot 7 times in the back with your kids in the car? And especially when we see a different kind of treatment, you know, for people who are not people of color. And I think this is a question. You know, when Laura Ingraham told LeBron James he should shut up and dribble. I'm kind of glad that he didn't listen to that. But talk about that. How I think for a lot of people, when you say racism in sports, they're like, all of these black athletes are super rich. They're making all this money. What are they complaining about? Explain to people what it is to try to ask a person to separate their beliefs and their causes from who they are.
It's very tough because a lot of times America won't allow you to do that. You know, they won't allow you to separate your beliefs from who you are. You know, I'm a basketball player. I used to be a basketball player. And the one thing I used to always tell myself is when I'm not on the basketball court, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm not a basketball player. I don't want to be identified as the basketball player. I want to be identified as a human being first and hopefully a good person second, and a good husband and a good father. The basketball is just part is what I do for a living. You know, so when you hear these people, you know, with that narrative, that, you know, he makes all this money, and like he basically is saying you should just shut up and be thankful because you have a career. Well, you know, a lot of us who have played sports have worked extremely hard to get to that profession and get to that level to be able to earn the type of money that we earn. And we should never apologize for that. You know, that's number one. But after that, when we're not basketball players, you know, my rookie year, I was pulled over in my Mercedes Benz, and I know good and well I was pulled over at that time because I was a black young man in a real nice car, and that didn't sit well with them at that particular time. The officers who pulled me over, one was black and the other one was a white officer, and me being from Inglewood, I was a little defiant. You know, I didn't take too kindly for you pulling me over for not speeding or anything, because when I asked why you pulled me over, I never got an answer until they found out who I was.
Right.
They found out who I was, and the guy said, okay, you're free to go. It's okay. And I said, what? No. What'd you pull me over for? Well, there was a Mercedes Benz that was stolen tonight, you know, and you fit the description. Now, the Mercedes Benz, as he told me, was a white one. Mine was totally red. You know, so I was like, you know, okay, so you see a black man in the car, so you want to pull him over. So it's very hard to separate, because sometimes society will not allow you to separate. What I love about our players right now is they're being able to separate and use that platform to use their voice. And not only are they using their voice, they're getting attention. And that's they right. know that they can get attention, and they're trying to make change. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and I think that people sometimes underestimate the emotional impact that these issues have, especially on black men who are very often the right. target of this kind of treatment. And you can certainly see that emotion coming out in the bubble right now. What does that look like to you?
It's very tough, because, you know, when I look at these young black men who are playing in the NBA, National Football League, Major League Baseball, all these guys, they, you know, the one thing about most of these guys is they have kids as well. You know, they have young black men that they're trying to raise. I know that they're going to have that talk, if they haven't had it already, just as I did with my kids when they were growing up, about how do you act when a police officer pulls you over? You know, because we are an endangered species, in my opinion, because, you know, they're shoot first, ask questions, you know, later. There have been so many unarmed African-Americans in the last 3 or 4 years that's been killed or murdered for no cause whatsoever. And like you said, there's a young man walking down the street at 17 years old with a gun hanging, with a shotgun hanging across his chest with his hands up, and they just kept going right by him. If he would have been a black kid, they would have stopped, surrounded him, pulled all their guns out, and if he would have made one sudden wrong move, he would have been dead. You know, so I think the point that we're all trying to make is that this, you know, enough is enough. I'm tired of having to see another black man or a young black man murdered on TV, or brutalized or shot in the back 7 times on a video. You know, it's just enough. You know, we got to get past this.
Well, it looks like this activism in sports will probably help to keep this issue going and keep it in the forefront. And so I, for one, appreciate the efforts of all the athletes who are, you know, taking often a considerable risk to their careers. I mean, all you have to do is reference Colin Kaepernick once again. But I'm so proud of all the things that you've done. Glad that you're finding a way to still stay involved. Love seeing you analyzing the games and talking about sports. And we certainly appreciate you taking some time for us for Justice Now tonight.
Pat, anything for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Byron. Byron Scott with us this evening on Justice Now, sports and entertainment. Deborah Howell joins us now to have a conversation with someone who we love and adore, who is really a Hollywood icon.
Absolutely, and not hard to look at.
Our next guest is best known for his starring role as Dr. Richard Weber, the Chief, on Grey's Anatomy. But we've seen him on stage, on screen, and television, and we are delighted to have James Pickens Jr. to join us tonight on Justice Now. How you doing, James?
I'm doing well, Pat. Thank you all for having me. I hope everybody's safe and well and healthy and all that good stuff.
Well, I know you guys are getting ready to go back into production on the show, which is pretty exciting coming out of the pandemic. Really, really busy. And you've stayed busy in your career. And as I was thinking about this conversation with you, I was thinking about the experience of black men in Hollywood. And I don't know if you ever read Lou Gossett's book or heard him talk about his first week in Hollywood, where he was stopped on Sunset Boulevard because the car he was driving was too nice, handcuffed to a tree. and left there for like over an hour until they found out that he was legitimately here. This experience of confronting racism happens to just about everybody who's a person of color. What has your experience been like?
I guess I could say I've been fortunate in that sense that I haven't run into it overtly. There was a time when you would go to auditions and there was a role you'd be going in for that call for the character to be, and I'm putting in quotations, can you be more black? I remember you used to get, and it would drive you nuts. Because a lot of times you'd be across a desk from somebody who was a lot younger than you, in a lot of cases just come out of business school, and they have no idea about what this business is, and it's definitely didn't think when they would ask those questions. And so that would be something that was a challenge for me.
Yeah.
A lot of times. And it was just, for lack of a better term, ignorance, you know. But I've had an actor friends of mine who've had stories were a lot more horrendous than mine. But it kind of went with the territory. I think things have obviously changed for the better, but they can get a lot better. They're not as bad as they were, but they're not as good as they could be.
James, in your address to the class of 2020 at Bowling Green University, you said, okay, you're graduating. You have a choice. You can get out there and look at the world with trepidation, or you can get back into your communities and be change agents. How do they become change agents?
I think by engaging the culture. I mean, obviously, the time we're living in right now is a perfect example of that. And it doesn't have to be anything overt. But it can be something as small as getting out there and telling folks, hey, are you registered to vote? Know that your yes means yes and your no means no. And align yourself with people who may already, or you don't have to invent a wheel. And just have a conversation. I think what's needed now more than anything is to have a real tough discussion, because that opens up avenues of thinking and not so much trying to create a reality and not listening to the talking heads and not this whole fear mongering that's going on right now. We have to make up our own minds, listen to our own hearts, be wise. That's the only way we're going to see some change here.
You know, people look at who's on TV and who's in film now and will feel like, you know, black people are doing really pretty good in entertainment. I think people forget the extent to which people of color were excluded from TV and film historically. And it's not that long ago since we've seen some of that change. But I think even more significant is the way our images have been relegated to stereotypes in the past. Certainly we see a lot of that changing. You look at a show like Grey's Anatomy, which has incredible diversity. How much do you think that diversity contributes to the success and longevity of the show that you've been on for how many years now?
Actually, we're about to start our 17th season.
It's crazy.
I think our show was unique in the fact that we had an African American woman who created this idea that she saw the world that included us. We had a conversation early on, I believe, it's even before the pilot, and Shonda had related the story when they were pitching the show originally. And my character, you know, was pitched as the chief of surgery. And the question was posed to her, well, why does he have to be African-American? And she said, well, in my world, why wouldn't he be? And those are the kind of conversations we have to have. That show ushered in a different way of looking at how we cast in terms of diversity, not just in terms of color, but also in terms of sexual orientation, on how big a part women play in this. You know, our character is a woman, but we had an Asian woman, Sandra Oh. We have Chandra Bailey, Chandra, who Wilson, who plays Bailey, this character who winds up becoming the chief of the hospital. And her character was originally looked at as a short blonde woman. That was the original breakdown. So I think a lot of that had to do with Shonda's champion diversity and wanting to see something that looked like us, that we could relate to, that sounded like us, that our history was the same and it was familiar. And I think the audiences instantly grasped that notion. Okay, I can take this journey with them because I know this journey. I'm comfortable with this journey with them. I want to see how it plays out to the end. And I think that's what's been a big ingredient to the success of our show.
And I think that a lot of time for those of us who are Black, we have hated stereotypes because we were looking for dignity. We were looking for some of the things that we see in our community, some of the different layers of people. And I know you worked with Chadwick Boseman in 42. And certainly he was someone who, I think that a big part of why people are so distraught over his loss, you know, besides the surprise of it all, is just the fact that he represented something that we'd like to see in the future of cinema. Talk a little bit about Chadwick, what he stood for, and how we have more images like that.
Yeah. Well, I think his story was so unique. You know, I had the pleasure of working with him, as you mentioned, in 42, which was really his breakout film. Brian Hegland was the director, and Brian saw and said, this is the guy to play this. But I think he brought such a humanity to those roles, and the fact that he played three historical roles, one right behind the other one, really cemented his place in all of our great stars over the past. And they were so different and diverse, you know, from Jackie Robinson to James Brown to Thurgood Marshall. And then to take a comic book character like Black Panther and change the landscape of Hollywood and how it brought such an excitement and a joy and a feeling of admiration and to the audience that came to see it was something that I don't think Hollywood expected. It surpassed anything any of their superhero dramas had done up to that point, and that we know how big that franchise was. But this was a whole nother animal because it brought a sector of the community that hadn't gone to the movies like that in a long time. Because they had somebody that they could cheer for that looked like them, who was powerful. And he was smart, and he was regal, and he was all these things that we embody that have been stripped away from us because of our history and our past. And he was able to say, hey, this is who we really are. This is what we attain. This is what we aspire to be. And this is what we can be. And I think audiences really took hold of that. And it was such a loss when I found out that he passed. But the fact that he was able to work for those 4 years he was diagnosed back in 2016 and work and bring that kind of work to the screen was a tribute to who he was as a man. Very humble, very professional, inquisitive, and willing to do the work. And he was like, and they come along every once in a while. They're like shooting stars. They come and they give off this amazing light, and then they're taken away, and then they go, and we have to appreciate him for the time he's here, and I hope we did that.
Well, I think that your description of Chadwick Boseman would pretty much work for James Pickens Jr. as well. Because I hate saying all of that. But thank you so much for everything you do to make us all so proud and to keep us moving forward in the entertainment industry.
Thank you. Thank you always. Anytime, give me a holler.
I'm Greg Mack. We're here with Keith Knight. He's got a new series coming out on Hulu, and it's called Woke. Now, Woke, I'm assuming, is that America is getting woke. Is that kind of parallel with where the series is going to go, Keith?
I guess so. You know, the timing of it is pretty kind of crazy with everything that has gone on over the summer. We finished shooting the season at the end of February, and then we sort of watched the season play out over the summer, and we're just like, oh my goodness, it's sort of crazy how just prescient it all is. But you know, when people say, "Wow, the timing of this is amazing. How would you manage it?" I just say, "Listen, police brutality and racism is evergreen. So this would have been on time anytime, 20 years ago, and 20 years in the future."
Yeah, you can go back even further. I think that the difference is now that people have cell phones and they're taking videos. That's Could you it. Imagine the videos that would have been shot back in the 60s?
I mean, just that's the thing is people need to understand that, like, it gets worse and worse as it goes back. Like, what don't we see? Even today, like, everything that we see on camera happens, you know, 1,000 times off camera. And so people need to understand. And here's the other thing. We shouldn't have to prove police brutality by having cell phone video. And like, even when we have cell phone video, a lot of times people get off. And it's just like, it shouldn't be that difficult to prove, but that's systemic racism for you.
I wanted to talk about your show, Woke. You actually started working on this, you know, or became known for working, you know, doing stuff like this back in, you know, when Boondocks was real big. I guess a lot of people were paralleling your work to that because you are a, animation or cartoonist? What would be the correct way to say that?
Yeah, I'm a cartoonist. And yeah, I've been doing a comic strip and comic strip stuff about race and police brutality for decades. And so to be able to take it to another medium, especially because my industry has totally imploded, it's a great opportunity, and I am excited. And it was important for me to be a big part of it because there were so many times where I would hear stories of people who have sold stuff to Hollywood, and then they don't have anything to do with it, and then all of a sudden, like, it comes out and they're not happy with it. So for me, it was like, if Hollywood is going to screw this up, I want to be right there.
So. Well, you got a pretty impressive guy helping you there, talking about Marshall Todd, the guy that wrote Barbershop. How was it working with him? Tell me about that.
Well, I'll tell you, Marshall really stood out at the beginning because they wanted to pair me up with somebody experienced, an experienced writer. So I was looking at a lot of samples, and there were a lot of samples that had a lot of tropes in them that sort of, you know, just sort of white girlfriend brings black boyfriend home, watch the white parents go crazy, you know, and just seeing that stuff sort of great. So it was really nice to read Marshall's script, which was completely bonkers out there and totally unique and different. So I was like, man, we may have to reel this guy in a little bit, but it was definitely the person to choose to work together on this project with.
Well, it's really exciting. I just have to say, I'm so proud of you, Keith Knight. And I wish this nothing but success. Hulu, it's called Woke, 8 episodes. Join me in a binge watch. And congratulations, man. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. And I appreciate everything. Thank you.
Our topic this week on Justice Now is sports and entertainment. And today we have with us the lovely, talented, Image Award winner. I got to throw it in there because it's in the background.
It's in the background. It's right there.
it's a distraction. Jim Coles.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
How are you, dear? We all love Sinclair.
Oh, I love Sinclair too. I loved doing her.
It was such a sweet character. She was just so sweet.
Yeah, she was sweet and naive. And some people say that she was dumb. I don't think she was dumb. I just think she marched to the beat of her own drummer. And I had the great joy of being involved in creating her. You know, people don't know this, but the show was actually created around Queen Latifah and myself. We both had deals at Warner Brothers. Yvette Lee Bowser was brought in to create the show. We got to sit down with her and create our own characters. So I got a chance to infuse her with a whole lot of goodness that to this day people say, woo, 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 or they say, hey, Sinclair. And I think I'm going to be answering to Sinclair until I'm like 153 years old, even though I've done other things and will continue to do other things. It holds a soft place in my heart.
Well, you know, it was a natural fit because you're just a sweetheart.
Oh, thank you, Frankie Ross.
Tell us about Kim Unity Mastermind. I just want to jump into that. What is that?
Yeah. So, long story short, I figured out that this can't be the only thing I do. That being an actress is fine, it's wonderful. But for me, I had desires and hopes and dreams to do other things, particularly because so many decisions about my employment rely on someone else. Mm-hmm. And so in 2010 or so, I started creating products and services based on the other gifts that I have. So my gifts are love and laughter and really understanding the power of storytelling. You know, as a comedian, I'm a storyteller. As an actor, I'm a storyteller. And that's just my jam. And so I began to take those gifts and shift them and use them to teach other people. So I teach the power of storytelling to entrepreneurs and, like I say, wandrepreneurs. And the Community Mastermind is my monthly, and it really is Kimunity, get it? Kimunity Mastermind. It's a monthly membership in which my business partner and I coach entrepreneurs, up-and-comers, speakers, coaches on building their business in a strong way, how to write your book, how to write a better book, how to brand yourself, how to build a platform for yourself that is strong and lasting, so that even when a pandemic hits, you're okay. So a lot of my peers, listen, the pandemic hit in the middle of what we call pilot season. Pilot season is the season where you go out and audition for all the shows, for the most part. Well, that all shut down for me, but I was okay because I'd already built this other business and brand around coaching others to their greatness. I like to call it helping others to broadcast their brilliance. And so I love doing that work. Listen, I was on a game show earlier this week that I taped, and that's fun. And I get to do this work, and that's fun too. So you can go to communitymastermind.com to get information. Thank you.
Adversity as a Black woman in Hollywood.
Oh.
I just want to get your take on that, because I know, I can only imagine some of the things that you were faced with and had to deal with.
But here's what's interesting. Maybe I'm a little different from a lot of the other. I feel it. I see it. So I've got, you know, racism. I've got ageism because I'm in my 50s. I've got sizeism because I'm not a size zero, and all those things. And so I've decided to, let me say this. I've had several opportunities in my career that have been the bright, shiny light that drowns out the darkness of that adversity. And what I mean by this is I was on a show and the producer overheard me saying that during the Christmas break, I was going to, you know, go to the gym a lot and really try to get my body fit and get really, you know, like really kill myself in the gym. Like when I jump all the way in. And she heard me, she was walking past and she said, do that for you. If you want that for you, do that. But we hired Kim Coles. We love you any size, any shape, we want your talent. And that was the bright, shiny light that could, like I said, drown out the negativity of, oh, wrong size, or oh, we're going to audition all the Black girls, even though we're not going to hire a Black girl. There's a funny thing that happens on auditions that I love to witness. You go in and there's often a sign-in sheet. I shouldn't say often, there's always a sign-in sheet. And it's almost like they bring in every race all at the same time, because I can look at the last names and tell who's there. So they're auditioning for one role, right? And you'll see when all the Latinas came in, because you'll look at the last names. You'll see when all the Asian actresses came in, because you look at the last names. And then you see all the Black girls, because now you're in the room with all the sister girls. And sometimes they hire one of us people of color, and often not. But I focus on the times when I was the right girl at the right time and I showed up and did my thing. And like I said, and maybe this gives me an extra boost of confidence, I have this other thing going for me that's so strong that is not reliant on an executive telling me to lose weight, or somebody saying, can you just do the line as written? Don't add your own thing. Somebody saying, we've changed your call time. None of that matters in this other world that I've built for myself. So I can almost weather the storm of whatever y'all decide to give me, because over here I get to be the executive producer and director. And I recommend that all artists, all creatives, all people find and use all of their gifts in that way, so that there's something that you control, something that you have that's yours, that is not dependent. It's dependent on how I relate to the customer and relate to clients and pull clients in, but they're the ones that get the final say, not a whole team of people sitting in an office somewhere.
What's your take on all of the brutality against blacks by the police that's been going on as long as we can remember, of course. So, you know, just how's it make you feel? George Floyd, I mean, there's something every day playing out in the news.
I hate to say, for me, it's still shocking. Like, aren't we past this? You know, I talked to my mother, who's 90, who says in some ways for her, it's worse now than it's ever been. She's lived through Jim Crow. She's from North Carolina. She's lived through, you know, not being allowed to walk over there or drink that water fountain or have that job. And for her to say, Kim, in many ways, it's worse. I don't know what to say about it. I don't know. I find it unbelievable that this is happening. And I think that now is the perfect time for us to grab our allies, shake them up, and go, you gotta, you know, they're not listening to us. Maybe they'll listen to you. I mean, I don't even know what the answer is. I don't know what the answer is. And I find it, like I said, shocking. And I don't know why it's so pervasive, and why every day you open up the computer and you go, okay, what's going to come through right now? What breaking news is going to come through now? I'd like to believe that, as I mentioned before, that the light will overtake the darkness. It has to. And that this is coming to a crescendo so that it can be shifted. There's enough of, you know, we've been saying for a long time, you know, we have rights, we matter, treat us right. We, you know, look at the history, own up to the history, and give us our due. I'm asking for us to have that fight and for our allies to step up and also open the doors where possible. You can see I lose words on this because I don't know what to say. And we all have a different way that we take on this fight. Mm-hmm. You know, my fight is to be be excellent in everything I do, as often as I can, as much as I can, and to inspire others to be excellent at what they do as often as possible, and to keep being a stand for the truth winning and the light winning. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's how I'll say that.
I mean, you're so positive.
I fight. That's the fight for me, though, Frankie. To be honest with you,
you're a positive person. I mean, you, at some point in time, you had to experience some type of racism in this business.
Absolutely.
And when you did, how did it make you feel?
Well, listen, the fight that I love to remind everybody about is living single. You know, living single came before friends, and yet the friends got the big paycheck, the big budgets. They were on the big lot, and we were on the little tiny lot off to the side. You see it and you experience it and you get awakened to it. You know, everybody uses the word woke now. Like, you get awakened to, oh, this is what we're doing now. And the only thing I can do is I fight to stay positive no matter what. And actually had a coach that taught me this that was so helpful, that you can't always be positive, but you can be powerful. So I make powerful choices all the time. I make as a powerful choice as I possibly can in order to stay positive. So yes, the racism happens. And like I said, maybe my answer to it was to go, I don't need y'all no more. It's nice if you call me and you want to work with me, great. But I think my answer was, I'm going to go over here and do this thing over here. Maybe it's not my fight to say, you better hire me or else. It's like, you don't want me there? Great, I'm going to go over here and do something else. So that's maybe that's how I do stay positive. Maybe for me, that would not be everybody else's fight. I think there's some people who are meant to knock down the doors, and I appreciate them and I support them. And may they knock down the door so that they can get in and everyone else behind them can. My thing is to go, okay, I'm just going to, I'm not going to beat down your door. I'm going to go over here and open up a new door for myself. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's probably not the most popular thing, but that's what works for me. I go and find a new door to open, and I, that is of my choosing, of my control. And yeah, that's my answer.
This is another episode of Justice Now. The topic, sports and entertainment. We're going to go back to Pat Prescott in the studio. Kim, thank you again. We love you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of our guests tonight. And thank you for joining us as well for this episode of Justice Now, Communities to Unity, a radio.com original brought to you by my2020census.gov. Take 10 minutes to change the next 10 years. And remember, the census deadline is September 30th. To help you learn more about racism in sports and entertainment, we've compiled a list of things for you to listen to watch, and to read. See all of that and past episodes now on 947thewave.com. And be sure to join us next Wednesday, September 16th, when Justice Now returns for an in-depth look at the challenges faced by business people of color.
94.7 The Wave. Justice Now.
On 94.7 The Wave. Play 94.7 The Wave on your smart speaker or watch every episode at 94.7thewave.com.